Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up on Word of Mouth, getting away with murder. Enraged after being denied tenure, Amy Bishop opened fire on 9 colleagues, killing 3. It turns out that this was not the first time she'd shot somebody. We'll look into the role a good family and an impressive academic pedigree played in concealing her violent past. Plus, in defense of jury duty, a former public defender talks about the importance of constitutional engagement and protecting the single dissenting voice. And social media revives the careers of departed celebrities, from Marilyn to Elvis. But we begin with questioning by robots. They may not be able to dream or feel emotion, but a recent study suggests that robots do a better job of getting accurate witness statements than their human counterparts. Sydney Bethel is an assistant professor at Mississippi State University. She specializes in human-robot interaction. And Cindy, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
She co-led the study with Deborah Eakin, a psychologist and associate professor also at MSU. Deborah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
All right. I'm wondering what prompted you first to look into the connection between spoken testimony and robots. I guess, Cindy, that would be a question for you.
Well, for me, it started out as an experience I had as a child, and I didn't actually share the information of what happened to me as a child until I was probably 25 years old. I would tell toys and tell animals and things like that my secret, but I wouldn't share it with others. And so I felt throughout the years that I really wanted to find a way for those children to have a way to express themselves in a safe environment. And so that kind of started this whole process, and we then did the study. We started out with using adults to interview.
How was the study actually conducted?
So everybody watches a slideshow that has been used before in investigating the misinformation effect in humans. And during the slideshow, a man comes into an office to fix a chair, and while he's there, he also steals some money and a calculator. And then people are asked questions by an interviewer, in our case, either a human or a robot interviewer. And some of the questions had neutral information in them, but some of the questions were misleading and suggested that specific items that were witnessed were actually different items.
I want to go back to something that you said. You said the misinformation effect. What exactly is the misinformation effect?
The misinformation effect is a comparison of memory for the details from the witnessed event, from the slideshow, between the group that got misleading information and the group that did not. And it's a robust effect found in human studies where the interviewer is a human, where people who are not misled have better memory for what they witnessed than a group of people who got this misleading information during the questioning.
So how did the human interrogators stack up against the robots in terms of the information that was told to them?
In the case of the humans, those who were not misled or received neutral information were able to accurately recall approximately 43% of the witnessed events, whereas in the condition where the participants received misleading information, they were only able to accurately recall about 26% of the items witnessed. In comparison, in the robot interview situation, in both the control or the neutral questioning versus the misleading questioning, the memory recall for the participants of the witnessed events was about averaging 38% recall. And the questioning was actually identical between the human case and the robot interviewer case. And we actually asked our human interviewers to be as robotic-like as possible, to not show engagement, to not show any kind of emotional expression, so that it would match closely with how the robot was behaving and interacting.
Deborah, I'm curious, why do you think that is?
The explanation that we think is the most fruitful to explore is that of social demands. Social demands occur when a participant in a study behaves in the way that they think the researcher wants them to behave. And so because the researcher was the one who presented the misleading information, people could have answered with the misleading information just because the researcher told them that's what happened when they asked the question. And so people wanted to comply with what they perceived the demands of the researcher was. And so they wrote down hammer, even if they remembered it being screwdriver.
So a desire to please the person who's interrogating you or
Correct.
Being a witness, but, you know, maybe feels
Yeah.
like an interrogator.
Huh. Yes.
Cindy, you're the robot expert here. Tell me a little bit about what the robot looked like who's asking the questions. What would that interaction be?
The robot that interviewed the participants was a humanoid robot. It's made by Aldebaran Robotics, and it's a NAO robot, N-A-O. It was in a seated position. We gave it a little bit of aliveness quality to it by having its eyes would light up when it was speaking. It would have face tracking, so it would follow a person as they were interacting, but it doesn't have an expressive face, so it's very neutral as far as being able to express any kind of emotional response.
So there wouldn't be the temptation to try and please the robot necessarily.
Right.
Where do you think your research is going to go from here? It's a really interesting partnership between you, the two of you.
Well, this is really preliminary research that we're doing, and we are in the process right now of replicating this study and trying to account for some different technical issues that may have come up. Like the robot at times was difficult to understand. So we're trying to replicate the study to verify that these results hold true even with the changes that we're making. Then we're also going to be looking at different forms of the robot. So does a more mechanical-looking robot versus the robot that we use, the NAO robot, versus more human-looking robots such as Xeno or Alice robots from Hanson Robokind, whether those impact, if it's the closer it looks to a human, will we have more social demands? Will that impact the memory for the events? We are also going to be manipulating some of the social demands to see in future studies if that impacts memory.
Deborah,
one thing we'd like to do is see if we can increase the social demands of the NAO robot that we're using by kind of providing a backstory that this is his last chance to participate in research, and if he doesn't get it right, he's going to the trash heap. So to try to increase the perception of the participants that it's really important to listen to what he has to say.
Fascinating stuff. I want to thank you both so much. Cindy Bethel, assistant professor at Mississippi State University. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Deborah Egan is a psychologist and associate professor also at MSU. Deborah, thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
They co-led a study that suggests that robots are better at collecting accurate witness statements than their human counterparts. You can read more about the study at wordofmouthradio.org. Here's another example of how facts can be misremembered or even distorted by time and relationships. A year after being denied tenure, neurobiologist Amy Bishop shot six colleagues during a faculty meeting on the University of Alabama Huntsville campus. Three were killed, and another was in the crosshairs when Bishop's gun jammed. Testimony from the remaining eyewitnesses helped convict Amy Bishop, who avoided the death penalty in a plea deal. She's currently serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole. The campus massacre was not Amy Bishop's first killing. In 1986, she shot her brother Seth at her family's home in Braintree, Massachusetts. Local police reports called it an accidental shooting, but after the murders in Alabama, Braintree's police chief reopened the case that some members of the force had always found suspicious. Patrick Radden Keefe dove deeply into Amy Bishop's past and published a detailed and fascinating portrait of a killer in an article for The New Yorker. He took us through the official story of what happened the day Seth Bishop was killed.
Well, back in 1986, it was just shortly before Christmas time, the police were called to the Bishop family home in Braintree, Massachusetts. And when they arrived, they found Judy Bishop, who was the mother, and she said that her daughter had shot her son, so Amy had shot Seth with a shotgun, that the gun had gone off by accident, and she had witnessed the whole thing.
And Amy had fled.
And Amy had fled the house in shock, it appeared. And Amy was subsequently picked up by the police. Both parents ended up going to the police station. And the police department released Amy that night. And the story for years was that what had happened was a pretty straightforward accident with the gun.
Now, what's interesting is after she fled the house, Amy, holding a shotgun, went to a local Ford dealership and demanded keys to a car, and she didn't put the gun down when a cop arrived and told her to. That incident was left out of the police report. What would have happened had that incident been reported?
Well, it's a pretty significant crime, actually, just to even point a loaded gun at people, and obviously even more so when you're pointing it at police officers. So she could have been charged with a felony count of assault. And had that happened back in 1986, there probably would have been a psychiatric evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the interesting things about this story is that Amy Bishop shot her brother in 86, and she never got any kind of therapy or counseling after that. There was never any evaluation to see if she was all right psychologically, mentally. And most likely, had the police actually followed through and had she been charged with assault back in 86, she would have been kind of fed into the system. You know, that seems like a fairly major red flag that they might have spotted early enough to potentially prevent what ended up happening in Alabama in 2010.
And yet the police let her go. You go through a couple of different theories on why that is. Her mother was a town official. She was very friendly with the police chief, who was, I guess, a kind of imperious chief at that time. So, you know, after this Alabama shooting, her parents said, Amy, well, she just snapped. It seems kind of minimizing. Can you talk about this family dynamic that was going on inside of the Bishop household?
Well, in the article, I actually interviewed Amy Bishop and her parents and spent quite a lot of time talking to her parents. And they're in a really unusual position, right, because they lost a son. They've had this terrible tragedy happen to them. But the perpetrator, whether it was an accident or a deliberate killing, was their daughter. And so they play an unusual role as the parents of somebody who then went on to do some terrible things. I think that there was some denial in the family, but also in the town and in the police department. And one thing I explore in the article is the idea that when you get these shootings and we go back and we look at the profiles and the biographies of the shooters, even, you know, most recently the shooter in Newtown, we look back and we say, God, were there red flags that we might have missed?
Mm-hmm.
Were there things that they did that we could have picked up on that would have helped us prevent this? And the interesting thing about the Amy Bishop case is, you know, here's a red flag. She shot her brother with a shotgun. She had a series of other incidents that probably should have gotten the notice of authorities over the years. But what I found is that the power of denial, not just in families, but in small towns, can be pretty strong. That tendency to say, oh, you know what, it's a private matter. Let's leave them alone. Mm. Let's kind of brush it under the rug.
Well, small towns also, and also academic circles. You know, she was a Harvard-educated neurobiologist. She got a PhD, although you spoke to some who kind of thought that she maybe should not have. That's a question here, Patrick, that you really address and you're addressing right now, that the idea of what are the degrees here? What are the warning signs? Is it because Amy was a woman, or is it more about the fine line between someone being thought of as kind of crazy and being a true sociopath?
Right, exactly. I mean, I think you've put your finger on it, because there are a number of cases in which she was somewhat unusual. The fact that she was an academic is part of it. And I talked to a lot of academics as I was researching this article who said, look, there's a lot of, you know, you go to any university campus, there's a lot of eccentricity. We don't want a situation where you're forcibly committing anybody who seems like a bit of an oddball. The problem is there's a continuum there between behavior that is just kind of benign but peculiar and somebody who actually is a little bit unhinged and capable of violence. And then the gender issue is another one which I think is important, in that if you reverse the scenario and you imagine that it was a brother who shot his sister, I think there's a much greater likelihood that the authorities probably would have arrested the brother rather than do what they did, which was essentially to let her go and say, of course, it must have been an accident. There's no way that she could have done such a thing deliberately.
We're talking with Patrick Radden Keefe. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he reported on the history of Amy Bishop, a University of Alabama adjunct professor who shot and killed three of her colleagues in 2010. And it turns out that she had also shot and killed her younger brother, Seth, in 1986. There are a few theories, Patrick, about why Amy took the gun out in the first place, and it was not because she was afraid of robbers. Why?
Well, what her family has always said and what she said at the time was that she had been alone in the home and had grown afraid of robbers. The family had actually been robbed about a year earlier, and they bought the shotgun as a reaction to this burglary that happened in their house. So they bought it for safety and for protection of the home. And the story was always that Amy took out the shotgun and loaded it because she was alone at home and thought that robbers might be coming. And then subsequently the gun went off, she says, by accident when her brother came home, when she in fact was trying to get him to help her unload it, was the story. As I dug into this and talked to the bishops and went back and looked at the records and talked to people who knew them, I became convinced, for a variety of reasons, that if you actually look back at some of the original testimony and conversations with the police officers, at least Judy Bishop, the mother, was actually home earlier. So Amy wasn't alone for that long stretch of time. Now, that doesn't necessarily answer every question about that day, but it does complicate this idea that she was alone at home and took out the gun because she was frightened. And that then raises the question, well, if she didn't take it out because she was afraid of burglars, why did she take this shotgun out and load it?
Now, you did an exhaustive amount of interviews and research in this case, including experimenting with the Mossberg 12-gauge shotgun that Amy actually used to shoot Seth. You pick this up and try unloading it, reloading it, becoming a kind of detective. Tell me a little bit about your role here as a journalist and an investigator for a piece of this scope.
You know, look, the truth is elusive in these cases, right? It's hard to figure out exactly what happened, and cold cases are tricky cases. It's always going to be difficult to figure out what happened back in 1986, long ago, when a lot of witnesses are dead, people's memories fade. I was just trying to talk to as many people as I could and weigh the evidence, and you know, I'm not a gun owner myself, but I did want to understand this Mossberg shotgun and what you would have to do with it. And one thing that I found when I actually spent an afternoon firing the same model that she had is that, you know, when you have a shotgun, you need to rack it after you shoot it in order to get a fresh round in the chamber. And one troubling detail about the Amy Bishop story is that if you look at the old police reports, after she shot her brother and the police eventually caught up with her and took the gun away, there was a live round in the chamber. The problem is, if you understand a pump-action shotgun, what that means is that after shooting her brother by accident, she says, she would have needed to pump the shotgun again in order to get that live round into the chamber. And for me, actually handling the shotgun myself kind of brought that home in a way that reading the police reports certainly couldn't have.
I understand that Amy did want to be tried in Massachusetts for her brother's murder, and still wants to, apparently. What ultimately happened with that case?
Well, what happened is that when she got life without parole in Alabama, the authorities in Massachusetts essentially said, hey, you know what, we're not going to bring her to Massachusetts, given that we don't have the death penalty, and try her for her brother's death. If all we could do is give her the same sentence she's already got in Alabama, that would be a waste of resources. And interestingly, in kind of a surprise move, Amy came out from prison and said, look, I want you to try me, because she's always insisted she was innocent. Her parents insist that she didn't deliberately murder her brother. And so she said, you know, a trial will be my opportunity to clear my name. The authorities in Massachusetts have not gone for that, and I have a theory about that, which is that I think while they have this indictment charging her with her brother's murder, I don't think they want to try this case because it would be a really hard case to try. The gun itself has disappeared. Nobody knows where it is. And the lead witness for the defense would actually be Judy Bishop, the mother, who was the only witness to the death.
Well, this is so interesting. Of course, all of this comes to us, your article, you've obviously been working on it for a long time, but it comes to us at a time after, post-Newtown, you know. Do you think parents are going to begin to look at their children differently and be maybe less willing to sweep incidents like this under the rug or keep them private or seek help for people who are mentally ill? And of course, the converse is that these proposals that anyone who's tagged as mentally ill won't be able to handle a gun in the future, will that keep them from seeking help?
Boy, I really do hope it causes people to look more closely at their own families and their own children. You know, it's funny, when you think about these things at a distance, you would assume that if anybody's going to spot signs of instability or red flags, it would be the people closest to somebody. You know, it would be that person's own family members. But the more that I delved into this story, the more I came to believe that, in fact, the people closest to somebody who's capable of killing in this way may actually be the last ones to realize what that person is capable of, because in some ways I think they can be blinded by their own attachment to the person. And I do think that that power of denial is really something to be reckoned with. So I hope that post-Newtown we can really think closely about those around us and getting people help in a timely way.
Patrick Radden-Keefe, staff writer for The New Yorker, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Patrick wrote the article, A Loaded Gun, A Mass Shooter's Tragic Past, for The New Yorker, and we do have a link so you can read it for yourself. It's an extensive article and a fascinating one. Stay with us. We're going to meet the cast of a stage production of To Kill a Mockingbird that's opening in the Seacoast region this weekend. Turns out they will all have their own backstories to tell, of course. And that's when Word of Mouth continues. Thank you.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. One day, you check the mail, flipping past the usual assortment of bills, credit card offers, and shopping catalogs. You find a letter that begins, "Dear Citizen." It's a summons to serve on jury duty. What's your first reaction? We asked some of our listeners on Facebook the same question, and Sean said, "Finally, it's about time," says Maureen. Stefan, who's already served twice, says, "Excited and somewhat annoyed. You will exit the process changed." Adi posted this, "I'd rather take poison." Andrew Guthrie Ferguson is a former public defender and author of the new book, Why Jury Duty Matters. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
You wouldn't have written this book, I wouldn't imagine, if you didn't think people needed some convincing. Now, our mostly ecstatic listeners aside, why do you think jury duty inspires so much dread?
I think it's a combination of anxiousness, inconvenience, and a bit of ignorance, honestly. And I think they're all a little self-reinforcing. You know, as you said, the jury summons comes out of the blue. We don't offer any training classes for jury service. You almost have to do more prep work to adopt a pet in some states than what you learn before you show up for a jury. And you don't know why you've been asked. You're not really sure what you'll do or what's expected of you. And I think we as a society do a bad job of explaining why jury duty really does matter. We don't explain why it has an educative role. We don't explain its constitutional role. And we don't really inform our citizens, which is sort of the reason I wrote this book, because as a practicing lawyer, I'd walk into court every single day and I'd walk past the jury lounge and I'd see those same emotions that you see on your Facebook page that combine frustration and boredom. And then I would see their experiences afterwards, after talking to them, after I'd been through a process that was literally transformative for many people. Mm-hmm. They'd seen the jury system in action. They'd seen the court system in action. They'd solved a hard problem with a bunch of strangers. They were reaffirmed of the value of this service.
The right to a jury trial was one of the first to be agreed upon at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, the only one to appear in both the Constitution and Bill of Rights. Now, what made a jury trial more universally appealing, more important for the founders than, you know, free speech or the right to bear arms, for example?
I think it's both a little bit of history and a little bit of identity of who we are as Americans. I mean, juries were central to the history of America. They literally, the right to a jury trial came over on those first boats to America. It's right there in the Charter of Jamestown. It was in each of the constitutions of each of the colonies and then each of the states. The denial of the right to a jury trial made it into the Declaration of Independence. One of the things we were complaining about why we began the War of Independence. And so you had history. It was clearly part of our history, and the founders knew their history. But it was also a statement of America and Americans about who we were supposed to be. If you think about it, right, jury service is a common enterprise, like democracy. We have to come together to do something for the common good. We have to look to our community. We even have to represent our community. And so the jury was always thought of this community conscience. There's also what it requires of you, right? Those first words of the Constitution, "We the people do ordain and establish," we have to do something as citizens, right? We have to be constitutional actors, and jury service is kind of a reminder that we have an important role to play. And it's practice and proof that we can play that role.
I'd like to play a clip from a film made in 1957 that still stands as a representation of the American jury. This is from 12 Angry Men.
Okay, are we ready? All those voting guilty, please raise your hands. Okay, that's 11 guilty. All those voting not guilty, 1. Right. 11 guilty, 1 not guilty. Well, now we know where we are.
Boy, oh boy, there's always one.
Oh, what are we doing now?
I guess we talk.
Now, you refer to this film in the book to illustrate what is probably the most difficult responsibility of the jury, to protect a single dissenting voice. Why is this so important, Andrew?
Dissent is an important constitutional value. I mean, it's one of the great justifications for why we have such a robust protection of free speech, because that free expression fosters a search for the best ideas, and it happens in jury deliberations. It happens in the movie, right, as the best idea comes forward. And so our idea of the First Amendment is that these views will compete in the marketplace of ideas, and the best will out. And in a jury, there are 12 voices, and they're sitting in a room, and you really have to, with unanimity, have to convince everyone that everyone agrees. And so it gives you a little opportunity to see democracy in action, to see that each, you know, that one person, one vote that we believe in really does mean something when you only have 12 votes and everyone has to agree. And so I think the recognition of dissent both connects our support and our belief in individualism, right? We're a country of individuals. We're a country that believes in individualism. But we also recognize we're in this sort of pursuit together, that we are deciding together. And I think that jury service is a small microcosm of democracy in that way.
You know, you made me think of like how often people see democracy on films and TV dramas portraying jury trials. I wonder how these dramatizations have changed public perception of the process, and for better or for worse.
You know, the hard thing about juries is that they operate in secret, right? So the real jury is never seen from or heard from, and that was intentional, but it also means that media conceptions of the juries can really overshadow the reality. You know, the movie I'd like to see that hasn't been made yet is what it was like for the first woman to serve on a jury after being kept off the jury for centuries, and what it was like for the first African-American to serve on a jury after being kept off. Because one of the forgotten realities of our jury system is that our political identity, how we view ourselves as citizens, is directly tied to our constitutional identity, and that, you know, the women's suffrage movement was very smart about connecting jury service and voting rights, because they recognized just the right to vote wouldn't be good enough. You also had to be able to serve as an equal on a jury. Same with the civil rights movement. Charles Hamilton Houston, one of the architects of the civil rights movement in the South, was focused on jury service as one of the first things to do. And so those voices are not heard. Those voices aren't in the movies, and maybe someone out there, well, Ken Burns, where are you? That's the movie to write. And as much as, you know, I love The Runaway Jury and John Grisham and the rest, it is a distortion, because the real work of juries, every single moment, right now, as we speak, they're jurors who are doing the hard, hard work of democracy in small rooms all over your state. They will never have a movie about them, but that's why it's valuable.
Well, Ken Burns does live in our state. He may be listening.
There you go.
Andrew Guthrie Ferguson, former public defender, now a law professor and author of Why Jury Duty Matters. Thank you so much for your time.
Of course.
Now, you can find out more about the book, including there are several YouTube video clips of Professor Ferguson talking about the book. You can also join the ongoing conversation on our Facebook page. Got a lively response today. How you'd react to a jury summons. That's on our Facebook page again. Word of Mouth Radio.
And so, a quiet, humble, respectable Negro who has had the unmitigated temerity to feel sorry for a white woman has had to put his word against two white people. The defendant is not guilty, but somebody in this courtroom is. Now, gentlemen, in this country, our courts are the great levelers. In our courts, all men are created equal.
That's a bit of the memorable closing argument delivered by Atticus Finch, as played by Gregory Peck in the 1962 film adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird. This weekend, the stage adaptation of Harper Lee's novel opens at the Rochester Opera House. And if characters like Scout and Boo Radley made the novel and film timeless, what makes this production stand apart is the characters who make up the cast. Sean Hurley introduces some of them in this radio playbill.
We begin with director Jonathan Rockwood Hoare.
This play was actually written after the film. It was written in 89 or 90. And it's actually done every year in the small town that Harper Lee is from. And the townspeople get together and play the parts every year. And to address their own history in that manner every year was such an honest, courageous way. I mean, that tells you something.
Sandy Clark plays maternal black housekeeper Calpurnia.
I didn't learn about black history until I was actually a young adult, actually in college, because it wasn't taught in school. I used to sit in classes, and I used to always think, didn't black people do anything to contribute to America? Didn't we do anything? And so I started researching on my own, Langston Hughes, different poets, and that's kind of what started me on my journey to find out more about what black people did.
Kylie Brown plays Jem, and Maddie Aubin is Dill.
Hey, Atticus!
Two young New Hampshire girls playing Southern boys.
It's very interesting, because I do ballet and a lot of girl activities, so it's hard to act like a boy, so I have to watch my two brothers and try to walk like them and talk like them and all that.
I think, proper boys, they, kind of tilt their chin up in the air, and they kind of, walk with their shoulders.
At auditions for Annie, I kind of saw this kid, Amanda, and her sister, and I looked at my girlfriend, Erica, who's in the show here, and I said, she'd make the perfect scout for a Mockingbird.
They were with Annie with me, and they were telling me how great of a scout I would be because I'm so like the character, apparently. I'm reading the book, so I'm seeing some similarities.
Amanda Cortina is scout, and David Durham, her father, Atticus Finch.
We lived in Los Angeles for 17 years, and I did more than a lot of people out there do, more television, Designing Women, Evening Shade with Burt Reynolds, Hearts of Fire, just enough every year to make me think next year is going to be the breakout year.
I would like to do it as a job, but I also know that it's hard to be an actor for a job because sometimes you don't get enough money and sometimes you don't get in place.
And it's her birthday today.
I know.
I just want to remind her, she was bursting to be interviewed by somebody, anybody.
I was like, yes! I was just like, I'm famous, finally. So, Oh, my God.
That's how we picked the show. It really was building it around. Some of the people I saw who I knew could be cast. My friend Timmy I knew would make a great Boo Radley.
Tim Plaisted is Boo Radley.
I did 3 years in Tenth Mountain. I did an 8-month tour in Kosovo for a peacekeeping mission. Got out, joined the National Guard in New Hampshire, and then did 14 months with them in Iraq. And then we were coming into Baghdad, and we were coming over a bridge, and I was looking through my little slots so I could see in front of us. I saw this one spot, and I said, wow, that would be a good place for an IED. And sure enough, right after I thought it in my head, a good 500-pound bomb blew up 3 feet from my face. Luckily, I had my gunner shield in front of me that took all the shrapnel.
There are 6 veterans altogether in the show, including John and Tim, who served with New Hampshire's 10th Mountain Infantry Unit.
2 years after I got home, I went into grand mal seizures and woke up 2.5 weeks later in Mass General, found out I have a brain tumor, and a traumatic brain injury is what they're calling it, TBI. It's kind of like an adult form of shaken baby syndrome. It's from the concussions of the blasts. It shakes your brain up so much.
Have you read done your reading for Mr. DuBose today?
Not today.
All right.
Please.
All right, go home. You do your reading for Mrs. DuBose.
Tom Whately plays prosecuting attorney Horace Gilmer. He discovered his primary theatrical gift was singing during an audition when he was 23.
So off I went and opened my mouth for the first time, and this sound came out. I didn't know what to do. It scared me. I didn't know I had a voice.
I wonder, would it be impossible for you to sing?
I can do the last little bit of Some Enchanted Evening.
Once you have found her, never let her go. Once you have found her,
never read the book in high school. I read it a year and a half ago when my daughter was born. I bought every book that I was supposed to read in high school, and I read them all in 6 months. I just did it. I'm a stay-home dad, so I was staying home with her the first 6 months, and the first 6 months, all they do is sleep, so I had plenty of time. And I just read, and this was my favorite one. I couldn't put it down.
From a close-up bomb in a faraway place to his very own baby, in this production of To Kill a Mockingbird, black meets white, war meets peace, and children and adults work and play side by side. Because what's brought to the stage is not only the words on the page, but everything the cast can carry with them from the world. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
To take a look at photos of the cast of To Kill a Mockingbird or to find out more about the production premiering this weekend at the Rochester Opera House, go to our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. Between 1978 and 1988, the murders of seven women in New Hampshire and Vermont were attributed to the Connecticut River Valley serial killer. Investigations of several suspects and one deathbed confession went cold, and the killer was never found. Novelist Joseph Olshan's Cloudland is a fictionalized crime thriller based on that case. In the novel, Cloudland is a rarely traveled road in an upper valley village where the crocuses don't bloom until April and where anyone not born in the region will always be from away. Olshan was an outsider living in the area when the sixth and final victim was found. We spoke to him last spring when the book came out. It's now in paperback. And he talked with us about how the fear of a roving murderer fractured the small town stillness of the upper valley.
It's a place where people usually leave their doors unlocked and go out at night jogging on the roads. And I just sensed that people were afraid, especially the people who had moved there from places like New York City and Boston, who were hoping to escape the kind of fear of the urban fear of being attacked, suddenly had to kind of reconnoiter and think twice about whether or not they're going to lock their doors.
Mm. And you became connected in your own way to what happened there.
A few people that I knew, one who became a very close friend, were actually out walking and they saw what they thought was a person taking sun leaning against a tree. She was wearing a ski parka and they went for a walk. And when they came back from the walk, she was in the same position. And then they realized that she, in fact, was dead and was the nurse from Dartmouth-Hitchcock College who had been missing since in the middle of January.
In the book, Catherine Winslow, the narrator of the book, the character finds Angela Parker 2 months after she'd been missing, frozen. What are the other things about the real murders that made it into your novel? Or what did you decide to keep and what did you decide to let go?
For me, I was approaching it in terms of what I could do and what I couldn't do. One of the challenges of being a novelist is to understand what your material is. I hadn't really written about murders before in this way, and so I really had to find my way into it. In a way, I didn't have that much of a choice about what I put in. I could only really write about what I could write about, and I sort of felt my way along in terms of the actual writing itself. I wanted to keep the writing at a certain fever pitch as much as possible because I thought that would make whatever story that I was telling compelling. And I found myself hoping to go back to some of these sort of brutal murders to be able to write about it, but in a lyrical way so mm-hmm. that they could be digested by the reader without being overly gruesome, if that makes sense.
It does make sense, especially after reading the book and knowing a little bit of your writing otherwise. And that's something that a lot of reviewers actually comment on, the way that you sort of, with sensitivity but directness, kind of use this language. And I'm curious about how you found a voice as a woman. She's kind of prickly, too. I wondered how you came upon this voice.
I mean, she's actually a composite of three different women that I know, all of whom are very, very strong and domineering in their own way. And these women are sort of like mother figures to me. They're always kind of chastening me and telling me that I should be better at what I do and very sort of quick with an opinion. So it was really, in a way, in my blood.
And Catherine is also a former investigative reporter for the New York Times. She's now writes a household hints column. Did you have to find out all these household hints? Can you actually get water stains out of wood with salt and mineral oil? Or
supposedly. I mean, I did do my research, and so I did find out that these things are possible.
Well, what purpose does that serve also? She's a household hint person. I mean, why did you choose that?
I actually do know somebody who did, a few people who have done columns like this, and I was kind of fascinated by it. And I thought that would be a great sort of counterpoint to somebody who was once in the world of really, really hard journalism and just felt that they couldn't make it and they wanted to retire to do something else, which is sort of journalistically related, but not nearly as challenging. Because this character has sort of, she was living in the big city and she retired from life and to the country, and she wanted to sort of keep her hand in the journalistic trade, but to do something that's not going to be so debilitating. Mm. Although she's not really proud of it either.
Yeah. Yeah. She writes under a pseudonym.
Right, and, you know. Right.
And the town is very much a character in this, I think. Like several towns in the region, you have, you know, the rich absentee landowners and the local caretakers. You have the college professors, you know, living next to the loggers. But it all gets kind of mixed up under the specter of this violence.
Well, I mean, I think that violence is the great equalizer, obviously. I mean, everybody is going to be, anybody who steps outside their house is going to be potentially a victim of a serial killer. And I also think that these events bring people together. They can put aside sort of socioeconomic differences and sort of band together in terms of trying to solve a problem that's sort of bedeviling a community.
One thing about this book, though, there are cell phones in the book. People are sending texts. So it is set in a contemporary time. Why did you choose to set it now instead of then?
I felt that setting it in the late 80s would require me to set up a time frame, mm-hmm. which I felt it was going to draw the blood from the novel into places where it didn't necessarily need to go.
Catherine has a troubled relationship in her past with a student. She's quick to point out he had left her class, but nonetheless, she's scarred by it, both sort of physically. He tried to strangle her at one point, and definitely emotionally. You know, you mentioned that you modeled her after several strong women, but yet she sort of takes this man back. Why?
When one loves, one does things maybe that are not necessarily rational. I mean, they have the expression, the heart wants what it wants, and sometimes against reason. The heart wants what it wants. And I think this man made a very deep impression on her. And I think that her reaction to him is sort of part motherly. You know, I think that he makes her feel young. I think that she is drawn back in partly against her will and partly because she feels that she has to complete something.
How about the place? You know, if a place can be scarred, like Catherine's neck, perhaps, how do you think the memory of that time and those murders has lived or stayed with this area?
It has stayed, and people are still, even to this day, working it out. When I went and did a reading in Norwich, which is 25 miles away from the town that I lived in, and the reading was packed, and quite a few people who attended the reading were people who had some connection to the victims. And the fact that somebody had written about it, they felt, in a way, they wanted to see what was done with the book and to sort of make contact with the person who'd written the book. And I've had that quite a bit, people who have had some connection to one of the victims contacting me, as if that's going to help them somehow deal with it. And I think it's a kind of scar that, you know, it is a scar, and so it never does go away, and people have to learn to live with it.
Joseph Olshan is a former book reviewer for The Wall Street Journal and author of 9 novels, including Clara's Heart and Night Swimmer. His novel Cloudland is out in paperback this month, and you'll find links to more on the book and on the real serial murder case that inspired it at wordofmouthradio.org. You're listening to Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. From NHPR, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, here to tell you that Elvis is in the building, or at least on your smartphone. Despite being laid to rest almost 35 years ago, the king of rock and roll still posts on Facebook and tweets several times a day. The BBC's Matt Danzico recently looked into the social media afterlives of departed celebrities and joins us now to let us in on a little secret. it's not really them. Matt, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So Elvis Presley is not really tweeting. So who manages the social media accounts of dead celebrities?
So who is doing this is a bunch of PR specialists, basically public relations specialists, hired many times, and especially in Elvis's case, by those who run the Elvis estate or dead celebrities estate. So for Elvis, that would be Lisa Marie Presley, who is the daughter of Priscilla Presley and Elvis Presley. And she runs Graceland, where actually these PR specialists are based. Mm. So I went out to Graceland to check this out. And if you've ever been there,
I
know that Graceland is this white, gigantic mansion. And it sits atop a grassy hill with beautiful trees. And it's this enormous tourist attraction. People will regularly show up on buses and sort of get out and immediately hit the ground and start crying. It's a religious experience for many people. But there's a chain link fence that sort of surrounds Graceland. And on the other side of one of those fences sits a very odd and sort of dirty looking office building without many windows. And so I went through multiple layers of security to get into this very, very drab office building and was led immediately to this back room past people sort of sitting in hallways, actually, into this room that was decked out to the nines in Elvis paraphernalia, mm-hmm. sort of Pez dispensers everywhere and everything you could ever imagine. And that was the office of the head of the public relations department there at Graceland. And he spoke to me about this. However, the strange part was that he would not allow me to speak to the person who actually ran Elvis's social media accounts, who was a younger girl who sat sort of in a windowless room, basically, tweeting out and putting up Facebook posts from Elvis. It was a bit of a bizarre experience, as you can imagine.
Well, of course, we've looked at celebrities or dead, let's say, illustrious characters who tweet or have Facebook pages, Leonardo da Vinci, Andy Warhol, Alfred Hitchcock, Albert Einstein, more than 4 million likes on Facebook. So where did the social media presence of, say, a Marilyn Monroe, where does it turn into cash? Who's profiting from these things, or why are they doing it?
So Marilyn Monroe, for instance, her estate is owned by this group called Authentic Brands Group. They're located in Midtown Manhattan. They literally bought the estate, so they own the rights to everything Marilyn Monroe. And so what they're doing is they have individuals who are tweeting out and putting up Facebook posts. You know, Marilyn Monroe has something like 7 million Facebook likes, but only about 100,000 Twitter followers, which is actually a lot. Anyway, so they run those accounts and they put up all this content. And the reason they do that is because they essentially use these accounts as marketing vehicles. You know, it's where all the eyes are. You know, years ago, you would have bought up television space to run your commercial. But these days, nobody's watching commercials. No one's watching television. Everyone's sort of on social media. So, of course, you're going to create an account to sort of market your product there. And that's exactly what they're doing when they're trying to engage with the audience and act as if they are still Marilyn Monroe.
Well, in some cases, we saw dozens of Facebook pages for dead celebrities. You know, Elvis is dead. Let's keep him that way. Elvis is dead. Get over it. I mean, can anybody start a dead celebrity page, or are there property rights that are involved?
It's very unlike domain squatting. You know, in the early days of the web, if Ford Motor Company had yet to secure a URL, I would buy up Ford.com, and then I would squat it and attempt to sell it back to them. You know, all of this is illegal. However, social media operates very differently. It's an entire different ballgame. Basically, if I grab the account Elvis Presley Twitter, at Elvis Presley or something like that, Twitter actually has the legal right to take that away from me.
There will never be any new Elvis Presley music, and every picture of him has pretty much already been taken. So even though the medium of Twitter and Facebook are relatively new, how long can that memory be recycled?
What's interesting is I was talking to the director of this group that heads up Marilyn Monroe's estate, and he was telling me Marilyn Monroe, the only thing that she ever wanted was to be watched and looked at and listened to, right? She just wanted attention. And what's interesting is in the digital age, she can still get that attention. You know, that obsession can still exist. And so when will this end? I don't think it will ever end. I mean, as long as we keep creating these platforms where we can regurgitate the same content that we digested decades ago, her memory will still live on. And I think she would be quite happy to know that.
Right. No wrinkles, no sagging. Matt Danzico, reporter and producer for the BBC, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
You can link to Matt's video about the social media lives of dead celebrities at wordofmouthradio.org.
you. I wanna be loved by you alone. Boop, boop, be doo.
And thanks so much for spending some time with us today. If you did miss any of the program, or if you'd like to pass a segment along to a friend, click on over to wordofmouthradio.org. That's where we have a pretty jam-packed archive of conversations and topics, of course, neatly arranged for your perusal, and easy icons to post them on Facebook or Twitter or send them to your friends. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again for more Word of Mouth next week from New Hampshire Public Radio.
I wanna be Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby, Zach Nugent, Jonathan Lynch,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoy, with plenty of help from our interns,
Ali Kosmikas
and Logan Shannon.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
Actually, that sounds pretty good.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals.
And not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to our past shows, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr at Word of Mouth Radio.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth
is a production of New Hampshire
Public
Radio. That's fancy, right?